It is 2:06 on Monday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. I am just thrilled that with me today is my colleague from WSB-TV, John Pruitt, who most of you in the audience know was the principal anchor along with Monica Pearson at Channel 2 for many years, but a journalist, John, in this community, covering a lot of the time politics for more than 40 years.
Yeah, and Bill, it's such a great pleasure to be with you, to talk politics, which we do on and off mic
exactly
all the time.
That's exactly right. And we have a wonderful guest to talk politics with. John A. Farrell joins us. His new book, Richard Nixon, The Life, is getting, I can only say, glowing reviews from just about everyone. John Farrell is, he's also written biographies of Clarence Darrow. He wrote a biography of Tip O'Neill. Tip O'Neill in the Democratic Century. He's a former journalist at the Denver Post. He was at the Boston Globe, where he was a White House correspondent, and he served on that amazing Spotlight team for a while, too. John, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure, and I didn't know we were going to be honored with Mr. Pruitt's presence, so this is a special treat for me.
I think, John, I don't want to assume anything about how long you've been around, but this is a we're old guys talking about Richard Nixon today.
Who actually covered Richard Nixon.
Yeah, that's right. John, I want to start out with something that you've said in a number of conversations about Nixon. I think I've got this statistic right. You tell us, I think, that 2/3 of the Americans alive today were not born when Richard Nixon resigned in 1974. Is that right?
Well, that you also have to include immigrants. So it's
okay.
But that's true. And right now, the single largest generation is the millennial generation. So when you write a book like a book about Nixon, you have to aim it at readers that, unlike you and I, were there and saw some of it and have ingrained feelings about Nixon, and try to tell the story dispassionately to young people who know Nixon as a caricature, the evil Paul, the guy on The Simpsons that everybody makes fun of all the time, the mask that the bank robbers put on before they go in to pull off a heist.
And one of the reasons your book has been so well reviewed is that you tell us the complexities of Richard Nixon, the contradictions in the personality that have made him such a fascinating person to study and reflect upon today. John Pruitt?
And John, I know that when you wrote this book and it was published, you had no idea who our president would be at the present time. And the parallel is there to draw. But I'm wondering how many parallels do you think do exist between Donald Trump and Richard Nixon?
I think there are a lot of coincidences. We just had Senate hearings on a definite break-in at the DNC. There's been allegations of eavesdropping, massive protest marches in the streets of Washington, an attorney general who resigns. And I had a friend down at the University of Virginia who called me the other day and said, this is like the Nixon years on speed dating. We're getting the whole thing in 100 days instead of 6 years. But beyond that, I think that the two men shared an approach. And in fact, Donald Trump in the campaign last fall went out of his way to quote Nixon on law and order and on the silent majority. And they identified a sense of grievance in the American Midlands and were very effective at tapping it and selling themselves as competent stewards who could come to Washington and change things.
John Farrell, as we go through our conversation today, I wanted to play some sound clips of Richard Nixon to kind of trigger some of our conversation. And although this came at the very end of his presidency, when he was speaking to his staff in the East Room of the White House on the day that we all recall who were around his getting on the helicopter and leaving Washington, we're going to hear a couple clips from that. But at this point in the conversation, I'd like to play a section that I know we're all familiar with. Nixon reflecting in a rather self-piteous way on his mother and his father. Let's listen.
I remember my old man. I think that they would have called him sort of a little man, a common man. He didn't consider himself that way. You know what he was? He was a streetcar motorman first, and then he was a farmer, and then he had a lemon ranch. It was the poorest lemon ranch in California, I can assure you. He sold it before they found oil on it. Nobody will ever write a book, probably, about my mother. Well, I guess all of you would say this about your mother. My mother was a saint. And I think of her, two boys dying of tuberculosis, nursing four others. Yes, she will have no books written about her. But she was a saint.
John Farrell, I play that for a couple of reasons. One, because it does show us the kind of the self-pity that really followed Richard Nixon throughout his life. But also because I thought you might tell us a little bit about, you tell us in the book about his early years in Yorba Linda and Whittier. What was life like for him back then?
It really was almost a Dickensian upbringing that he had. Most of what he said in that speech is accurate, except for the fact that they never did find oil on that property. It actually became a public school grounds, which is why if you go to Yorba Linda today, you can still see intact the house that he was born and grew up in. But he definitely grew up in poverty in the California outback. There's a photograph in the book of what the valley looked like when the Nixons first moved there, and it looks like Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl days. And his mother was a very religious woman, sort of severe. She would retreat into her closet to pray. And as Nixon famously said, never in my life did she ever tell me that she loved me. But she was a good-hearted woman who took care of his older brother, Harold, who died an agonizing death, 6 years of tuberculosis. And as he says in that speech, other tuberculosis patients as well. His father was a blowhard, borderline abusive. And so when you had this sort of combination of a seething volcano of a father and a glacier of a mom, Dick was always sort of caught in the middle. And he had two brothers that died, not just Harold, but also his youngest brother at the time, Arthur, a little golden-haired baby of the family. And they were the two parental favorites. The oldest son shined in his father's eyes, and the little baby shined in all their eyes. And to have them both gone, and have his parents tell him, in fact, how much they missed those two because they were the best and the brightest in the family. It all had this horrible effect on Nixon's sense of security, which was compounded by the fact that he was poor, that he didn't get a chance to go to the Ivy League colleges that he could have gone to because the family didn't have the funds for it. He had to work all his life in this little family grocery that Frank Nixon built out of an abandoned church on the crossroads out of town. And Nixon, it's both the strength and the weakness of Richard Nixon that he did it all by himself absolutely nowhere.
John Pruitt, I know you were really taken by this book and by the way John Farrell wrote it. But you know, one of the things that I was fascinated by, John Farrell tells us that when he was a young man back there in those days, he liked to do little kindnesses for people in the community. Farrell paints a somewhat different image of a kind of a kind-hearted guy who helped
his
neighbor.
Very thoughtful man, wrote a lot of thank you notes. Maybe that was his Quaker heritage, I don't know. But John, you might comment on that, but I would also like to talk about Nixon, the common man. He always was reaching out to the common man, much in the same way Donald Trump was, but in this case, Richard Nixon really was a common man from very humble beginnings. Can you tell us a little about how he used that heritage politically? I know in the Checkers speech, he used it to dramatic effect.
Absolutely. The Republican Party, if you remember, up through the Great Depression, was the party of Wall Street and a little bit of Main Street as well, and some farm communities. But mainly it was identified with the bankers and the financiers of Wall Street. Nixon was the first, one of the first, if not the first, major Republican candidate who, coming out of World War II, identified with all the GIs coming home from war, was picked for that reason to be on Eisenhower's ticket as vice president, and as you say, got in trouble when it was disclosed by his political foes that he had sort of a slush fund to help him pay his political expenses. And he went on television and he told this somewhat maudlin tale about how little money he actually had and how his wife wore a good cloth coat. And the only thing that they had taken was a little Cocker Spaniel puppy named Checkers. And by golly, no matter what they did, they weren't going to take that dog. They weren't going to take that dog away from his daughter.
Hey, John Farrell, let's listen to just a little bit of that speech.
One other thing I probably should tell you, because if I don't, they'll probably be saying this about me, too. We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat in the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, the day before we left on this campaign trip, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. We went down to get it. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. But just let me say this last word. Regardless of what happens, I'm going to continue this fight. I'm going to campaign up and down in America until we drive the crooks and the communists and those that defend them out of Washington. And remember, folks, Eisenhower is a great man, believe me. He's a great man. And a vote for Eisenhower is a vote for what's good for America.
Republican Senator. We edited out just a little bit there, which is what John Farrell talked about. I'm keeping that dog.
But because of the speech, Ike kept him on the ticket.
Exactly.
And John, this was a time when television was relatively new in American households. And according to your book, the reaction was overwhelmingly positive.
And it was, and especially in middle America. This was as many people said afterwards, this was the first bold stroke by a Republican candidate to claim the little guy, the common man, suburban mom, soldiers home from war, the vast middle America that Nixon would eventually call the silent majority. And he was tremendously successful. It may go down since now television is sort of waning or in influence compared to the rise of the internet. This may go down as the single greatest use of television by a politician ever.
And it was, I guess, the first really great political speech that had enormous impact, at least in terms of political future, certainly Nixon's political future.
Right. There had been some televised hearings on Capitol Hill, but this was the first one-on-one speaking into the camera, plucking the heartstrings.
Yeah. You know what? Here's a quote. You have a tremendous quote early in the book, I think, John. It's Bryce Harlow. And I think it plays into that Checker speech and his fighting for his survival. Bryce Harlow, who is his good friend, and of course would be a part of his administration, said, Richard Nixon went up the walls of life with his claws. That is an incredibly vivid description of the way that Richard Nixon played his whole political career.
He had to. He had nothing. He had no family fortune like JFK. He had no machine like Harry Truman. He had no name identification like Dwight Eisenhower, no glittering military record. He had no time in office like Franklin Roosevelt as governor of New York to point back on. He started from nothing, and in 6 years, he was vice president of the United States. And that, I think, is a great testament to the qualities of the man.
He just very quickly, so he decides to, he joins the Navy. And he's really in a position in the Navy, you tell us, where he could have stayed out of harm's way, but he insisted on going to the combat theater in the Pacific, right? And when he comes out, he's a kind of a dashing young officer. You say You don't really quite say he was handsome in his... I sort of took from that, if you squinted when you saw him in his dress blues, he was kind of good looking.
we're all handsome in our youth.
Right. And his political career started shortly after that. Tell you what we've got to do, though. We're going to take a break right now, a short break, and continue our conversation with John Farrell, the author of Richard Nixon, The Life. And we'll pick up on Richard Nixon's life story. But I'd also, and John Pruitt, who has been a journalist here since the 1960s and knows the South well, wants to talk a bit, and I think he's absolutely right, about how Richard Nixon played in the South and how the South changed while Nixon was in office. So we'll be right back on Political Rewind with John Farrell after this.
If we heard from you during our recent fund drive, thank you so much for your support of GPB. If not, there's still time for you to join us as a public radio hero. This spring, we're counting on the participation from everyone who listens to GPB, so we can continue bringing you the in-depth news you depend on and the entertaining programs you enjoy. Please take a moment to give online now. Go to gpb.org and click donate. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. You know, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Get in on this conversation. We'd really love that. I'm joined in the studio by former WSB TV anchorman, John Pruitt. And joining us to talk about his book, Richard Nixon, The Life, John A. Farrell. John, so just going back to the early career, so he comes out of the Navy, he launches a campaign for Congress, and early in his career... as we heard it in the end of his Checker speech, he's already red baiting with his first congressional race, right?
Absolutely. It was one of the interesting things I discovered doing the research out at the Nixon Library. Nixon was always one to sit there with a yellow legal pad and make lists. And the list would say, you know, get in contact with the local VFW halls or put in the order for advertising and billboards. And at the bottom of one of these lists, as he begins to put together his campaign to campaign against Jerry Voorhees, who was the Democratic incumbent, he writes, put spies in Voorhees camp. So even at the very beginning, he had this sort of nose for intrigue, this susceptibility.
I wanted to ask you about that quote. By that, are you talking about he wanted people of his in the Voorhees camp, or he wanted to create the impression that the Voorhees people were spying on their own country?
Oh no, that he wanted to insert people in the Democratic campaign that could report.
Okay,
back
just there. Wanted to make sure I understood
that.
Okay, and then he did the same thing, John Pruitt with Helen Hagen. I'm blocking her.
Douglas, of course.
Same thing, red baiting on her, and it got very nasty in that Senate campaign.
That was a staple back in those days, but then you move into the 60s, and the politics becomes about race and civil rights, at least in the South, where Republicans were beginning to gain a foothold. Goldwater carried, certainly Georgia in 1964, 66, Georgia had a Republican candidate for governor who got a plurality but was not seated because it went to the legislature. Lester Maddox was governor. But the South was in turmoil, and Georgia was very much in play politically. Then you have Nixon as a backdrop for all this. And, John, one of the fascinating things in the book to me was Nixon's view on race and how it evolved politically, because he began early in his career as an outspoken champion of civil rights and someone Martin Luther King Jr. looked to with great respect.
I think
but that changed.
Yeah, you say, don't you, John, that MLK was quoted once as saying that Richard Nixon doesn't have a racist bone in his body?
Yes, it was Nixon's path on civil rights pretty much traces that of the Republican Party as it moved from being the party of Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt towards being the party of the solid South that we have today. When he first started out, he was much more concerned about the big black districts in the northern cities, especially when he was running against John Kennedy in 1960. He knew that he had to get about a third of the vote in the black districts. And so as vice president, he made several amazingly courageous rulings on the 1957 Civil Rights Bill. And Martin Luther King wrote to a journalist that this man doesn't have a racist bone in his body as far as we can tell. But if he does, then he is so convincing that he's the most dangerous man in America. Now, what happened was in the 1960 race, Dr. King was arrested at a protest in downtown Atlanta, and he was handcuffed and sent away in the middle of the night to a rural prison on an old traffic charge. And both campaigns, JFK and the Nixon campaign, were confronted with the issue, what to do. And the Kennedy campaign played it better. They got in contact with the governor of Georgia, who was a Democrat, and they worked quietly behind the scenes to get Martin Luther King freed. They let it be known that they were doing this and that they were talking with Mrs. King to console her. And the Nixon campaign, even though he had very good friends like Jackie Robinson, their only reply was no comment. And so Nixon at that time was tantalized with the idea that he could pull the Carolinas, take Florida, Tennessee, and Texas away from the Democrats down south. And so this was his first sort of step away, and Martin Luther King was particularly embittered. He decided that this showed a lack of moral character.
Kennedy went on to carry Georgia substantially in 1960.
In 1960, yeah.
And in 68, when race was such a big factor in the South, George Wallace, of course, luckily for Nixon, running as a Democrat. He carried Georgia in 68. It was 72. He was running as a Democrat. But when Nixon was in the White House, it seemed like everything changed, and race became, to him, a very cynical political calculation. Could you talk a little about that and how it turned with the use of code words such as law and order, the silent majority?
Yeah, the first hint of what came to be called the Southern Strategy occurred at the 68 convention when Ronald Reagan made a late entry into the race and was actually threatening Nixon's nomination, stealing away some of the Southern delegations. And one of the ways that the Nixon campaign fought back was to identify forced busing as the great evil, and that was the code word then. But Nixon also, I discovered in the notes out in Yorba Linda at the Presidential Library, Nixon also sent his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, to the Southern delegations with the promise that if Nixon was elected, he would, quote, cut out the pro-Negro crap. And that was a promise that Nixon kept. JFK and LBJ had sort of identified the White House and the presidency with the cause of civil rights, and Nixon dropped it. It doesn't mean that he doesn't have a good record on race as president. The Supreme Court certainly put a gun to his head and forced him to act, but more Southern schools were desegregated and desegregated peacefully by Richard Nixon than any other president. And at the height of the desegregation effort run by Nixon's administration, by George Shultz and others, Nixon actually had a plurality, a positive rating among Southern blacks of 43% to 40%. He also was his administration was the great initiator of the affirmative action. So you can't look back at Nixon. He's a complex character. He would take these steps, but then realizing that they might alienate voters, he would like bury them. He didn't want the credit for being the great desegregator of Southern schools. He just wanted it done. He wanted it done quietly. And he and his people worked very hard and very successfully. And it was a significant record of accomplishment.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. Again, it goes to the incredible complexity of this man. And I think, John Farrell, it also may be, given accomplishments like those you're citing, Title IX happened, the very important rule that equalized funding for women in colleges and universities and their programs. He, I think with a gun to his head, was willing to go along with that. He didn't really want to, but that was a very liberal, progressive position to take, yes?
Oh, yeah, he established the Environmental Protection Agency, OSHA, Social Security Cost of Living Raises, the Endangered Species Act. His administration, of course, he had a Democratic Congress that was putting this stuff on his desk, but they worked with that Congress, and it's an amazing volunteer army, lowering the voting age. I always try to sum up Nixon's complexity with a story about Bob Dole. Bob Dole has probably the greatest wisecrack of all time in Washington. He went to the White House to be part of the delegation that was going to Anwar Sadat's funeral, and there was President Jimmy Carter, President Gerald Ford, and President Richard Nixon, and Dole said, "See no evil, hear no evil, and evil.
And anyone who has covered Bob Dole knows the sense of humor out of which that came.
But Bob Dole was also the man who gave the eulogy at Richard Nixon's funeral. And it's hard to watch because he breaks down in such agony as he tries to get the words out at Nixon's funeral. And he always remembered, Bob Dole, of course, was wounded horribly in World War II. He always remembered that of all the politicians he met, Richard Nixon was the one who always extended his left hand because Dole couldn't shake hands with his right hand.
Yeah.
He never forgot that.
John Pruitt, it occurs to me that when we talk about the Nixon accomplishments, we know the drama that ended the administration. We're going to get to that, of course. But it because there were so many things that went right for President Nixon, it's really no wonder that many people have said to him later in his career, history is going to remember you more kindly than we remember you now. Although, John Farrell, it's interesting that Nixon responded to that usually by saying, it depends on who's writing the history. That's you,
well,
John.
Yes, and also the media. We haven't really talked about the media, but with a record of accomplishment that Nixon unquestionably had, and we haven't even talked about China and Soviet Union, I have to ask John, why do you think Nixon doesn't get the credit? Is it the media? Is it the interpretation of the media who, I think, assuredly had a negative view of this man for whatever reason?
I think the original title for the book was Richard Nixon, an American Tragedy. And there's no denying that he had this tragic side, this tragic flaw. People like Henry Kissinger and Elliot Richardson, if you go back to their writings during Watergate, they are constantly comparing him to Shakespearean tragedy or to classical Greek tragedy of this hero who has a character flaw and knows what his doom is going to be if he doesn't overcome it and yet succumbs to it anyway. And that, I think, is one reason. I mean, there was certainly a dark side to Nixon, and the tapes show, the White House tape recordings that he made of all his conversations in the White House show over and over again, ugly, ugly Richard Nixon. I think also that, you know, he's never going to get past the notion that he was the one president had to resign in disgrace. And I think that the Vietnam War will always be, as it was for Lyndon Johnson and to a lesser extent JFK, a black mark against him as well.
Well, there's
Go ahead. That said, C-SPAN just recently did a poll and of all the presidents, and Richard Nixon was in the 20s.
Yeah, I was surprised by that.
Yeah. So, I don't know if you guys have kids in the millennial generation, but to them, you know, Vietnam is this little historic package that's up there on the shelf next to Korea. It's not the big, gut-wrenching historical occurrence that it is for us. And my son went to Vietnam as a tourist, and he rode a motorcycle from Saigon to Hanoi. And I said, you know, wow, didn't you like feel strange that you were looked at as the enemy? And he said, no, Dad, they won.
Yeah,
quite a different perspective than us.
All my millennial son thinks about with the Vietnam War is that I had really long hair, and he thinks that's funny. Hey, John Farrell,
burn those pictures.
John Farrell, when we talk about the dark side of Richard Nixon and some of the reasons that history will be balanced in the way it views him, good and bad, you uncovered what became a really important news story. The suspicion had been for a very long time that during his 1968 campaign, Richard Nixon found a way to influence the Paris peace process to encourage the Viet Cong, excuse me, to hold off on coming to agreement. Tell us that story and how you discovered it.
Yeah, you encapsulated it pretty well, except it was the South Vietnamese that they encouraged to drag their feet, not the
Viet
Cong.
Oh, of course. I'm sorry.
Nixon had a campaign aide named Anna Chenault, and LBJ caught wind of this. LBJ desperately wanted to wind up the war before he left office. He caught wind that Anna Chenault was talking to the South Vietnamese and saying, you know, hold on, if we're going to win, and if we win, you'll get a better deal. And so Johnson's 11th hour peace initiative fell apart right before the election. Lyndon Johnson got on the phone with Richard Nixon, and Lyndon Johnson taped his conversations too. And that phone call is on the record at the Johnson Library, in which he's probing Nixon, trying to get Nixon to admit that he was doing this. And Nixon denies it, says, absolutely no, it never happened. you know, a few years later, the Frost-Nixon interviews are on television, and David Frost specifically asks him about Anna Chenault. And Nixon says, had no idea she was doing what she was doing. And, you know, again, doing the old reporter's tricks of turning every page, I came across a page of notes in which Nixon is talking to H.R. Haldeman, his chief of staff, and he's telling Haldeman, keep Anna Chenault working on the South Vietnamese any way we can monkey wrench the Johnson peace initiative. Now, in his defense, Nixon thought the whole thing was a dirty trick being played on him. He thought it was a October surprise that Johnson had cooked up to help Hubert Humphrey get elected. But the papers at the Johnson Library show, tragically, that this was a very real peace initiative, or at least the Johnson administration thought so.
That strikes me as a rather thin defense. I mean, after all, we're talking about, here's a parallel between what we're watching going on with right now with the Trump administration and questions about Russian interference in the election and whether there was communication going back and forth. And regardless of whether Nixon thought that the trick was being played on him, he nevertheless was a civilian. He was not in office. And so any communication that he was involved with the South Vietnamese leadership was, I think, illegal. Isn't it?
We're talking treason.
Yeah.
Potential treason.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's treason. That's what Johnson said. I don't think it's treason because South Vietnam was an ally. But there was this law that was passed back by the founding fathers to deal with exactly this kind of situation. Somebody, a private citizen of the United States, intruding in the diplomacy of the United States, called the Logan Act. It's very difficult to prosecute because you really get into questions of free speech. But it seems on the face of it that Nixon was breaking the law by breaking the Logan Act.
And John,
but as a biographer, you know, I can't make the argument that the war would have ended in November 1968.
Right.
You know, the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese proved to be so stubborn. But as a biographer, as a glimpse of what this man was willing to do to get elected and what how his thought process worked, I thought this was a huge window. And I said in the book, it's probably more reprehensible than anything certainly that happened in Watergate.
What was the moment like when you made that discovery as a biographer? That must have been extraordinary.
Big news.
Now, my old journalism training took over, and I was like, "Oh my God, I'm not gonna. How do I keep from losing this scoop?"
I understand. By the way, we should point out, John Pruitt, the Logan Act is we've heard it again recently because the story that perhaps Mike Flynn and others who were representing the Trump days before he became president, when he's president-elect, may have talked to the Russians about not responding in any kind of hostile way to activities that the Obama administration was taking in terms of. So it's fascinating. There is a parallel there. Tell you what, let's get our last break of the show. And John Farrell, can you stick with us for a little while more? It's really
absolutely
great. Terrific. All right.
I'm having a great time.
Good. So you're listening to Political Rewind. John Pruitt is with me. John Farrell, author of Richard Nixon and the Life. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back with more of Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, the history of government-mandated housing segregation in 20th century America in the North. We'll talk to Richard Rothstein, author of the new book, The Color of Law. The government policies he writes about explain how housing projects became predominantly black and how suburbs became predominantly white. Join us. Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
It's just about 2:40 on Monday afternoon. I'm joined in the studio by John Pruitt, former anchorman of WSB TV. Did I say it was Monday? Okay, it's Monday. WSB TV. That's why I have it staff in the other room, John Pruitt. WSB TV, longtime anchor and reporter for them. And we have with us in a studio in Washington, D.C., John A. Farrell. He is a former White House correspondent for the Boston Globe. He also served on their Spotlight team, and he was at the Denver Post. And his biography of Richard Nixon, Richard Nixon, The Life, is getting glowing reviews from everyone. And I think John Pruitt, for good reason.
Absolutely.
Farrell is not only has he uncovered lots of stuff, he's really a good writer.
It's a good book. It's a page turner. I'll be
okay. Honest can we
you.
Wrap this up? I'm gonna go on the high note.
Well, we're all reporters, you know.
I want to spend because I think this is where perhaps we can talk about some of the parallels between Richard Nixon and maybe Donald Trump, and that's their relationship to journalists. And I want to go back to. Remember that in 1962, I'll tell you what, John Farrell set this up for us. Nixon loses by a hair's breadth the 1960 presidential race to John Kennedy, and he kind of doesn't know what to do for a while. And then in 62, he decides to run for governor against Pat Brown, right?
Right.
So
He doesn't really want the office, but he sort of wants to stay alive in national politics. The last thing Richard Nixon ever wanted to do was to be stuck in Sacramento worrying about water projects and highways.
Yeah. Sort of kind of way President Trump may be thinking he shouldn't be stuck in Washington. But he loses that race. Right. And he feels as if he's been assailed, that every time he's turned around, the press has been out to get him. Is that a fair characterization, John?
Yeah, especially in California, where the press in Southern California for very many years was dominated by the Los Angeles Times, yeah. A very conservative newspaper that really threw its weight around a lot and had been sort of a mentor to Richard Nixon, had given him glowing coverage. And then all of a sudden, in 1962, the press across the country is becoming more professional, more objective, more aggressive, and they begin to cover Nixon like... he's just a regular candidate. He sees this in part because of the upbringing with his dad. He sees this as an attack upon him. And the only time I sort of stop the narrative of the book is to talk about Nixon's evolution on civil rights, but also to talk about the roots of this amazing antagonism between Nixon and the press. And there is a comparison to Trump, I think, in that Trump became a national media figure in New York by entrancing the tabloids, the New York tabloid culture. And then all of a sudden, he moves out into the national scene, and he's being covered in a different way, a much more aggressive way by half the press. And to me, there are definitely similarities there, and even down to the point where there's a famous quote on the White House tapes by Richard Nixon, in which in the middle of the bombing of Hanoi at Christmas time in 1972, he goes off on a tangent and he starts lecturing Henry Kissinger. The press is the enemy. The press is the enemy.
Yeah, we're going to listen to that, actually.
Yeah, okay, great.
So
yeah.
Let's start with the earlier story. To the best of my knowledge, it's after he loses the 62 race. He holds a news conference, and to the best of my knowledge, the first time he ever really expresses in a very public way his resentment, his bitterness about the media, is in that news conference after he's lost the California governor's race. It's a very short clip, but it's very famous, too.
Yep.
Just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
John Pruitt. You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
We all know the line. And John, I'm wondering if the animus that Nixon held for the press, which was deep-seated, almost pathological, did it really begin in the 60 presidential race where he felt Kennedy, this suave, urbane, rich Massachusetts young man, was getting all the great coverage, and he, a guy from a poor family, scrapping his way up, was getting negative coverage?
That was certainly true, although at the time, most of the newspapers endorsed Nixon over Kennedy, but definitely the rank-and-file political reporters were dazzled by the Kennedy-Camelot shtick. But it actually goes back even further. It goes back when he first gets to Washington, and he does two things. One, he does an amazingly courageous thing by supporting the Marshall Plan, and he goes back to California, and he risks his entire career, and he sells it to his constituents. And says, look, we've got to be internationalists. We have to help the countries of Western Europe. They're not lazy socialists like you think. And there really is this great threat that if we don't help them, that communism could take root. Big gamble for Nixon, big success. But the other thing that happens is that he is sitting on the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they identify a fellow named Alger Hiss as a Soviet agent in the U.S. State Department. And Nixon goes after him like a bloodhound, And Nixon is astounded at how the liberal New Deal establishment rallies behind Hiss to protect Harry Truman, to protect Franklin Roosevelt's legacy, and ignoring the fact that Hiss was indeed a Soviet agent. And Nixon begins to get treated by the press as this sort of crude Neanderthal. You begin to get the first few cartoons of him with the heavy beard crawling out of the sewers. And that really is the point where he begins to grow very, very bitter about the press.
And it gets worse and worse. And John, you started to talk about the what we hear listening to the tapes of Nixon's Oval Office, which he does just what you've said. It's a little hard to hear this because it is from the Nixon tapes, but here is the quote in which he's talking to Henry Kissinger about what they have to remember about the press.
And also, never forget, the press is the enemy. The press was the enemy. The press is the enemy. The establishment is the enemy. The professors are the enemy. The professors are the enemy. Write that in the blackboard 100 times and never forget it.
And that's where we start thinking again about a parallel. Donald Trump talking about the press as the enemy of the American people.
I sometimes wonder if Trump is not using that because it plays well. Who am I to say? But I'm questioning whether it's as deep-seated as the hatred Nixon held for the press. John?
I think you're right. I would say that, Nixon's was almost pathological, again, having watched Trump a little bit in New York back in the day, he really knew how to play the tabloid game. And, you know, it makes you cynical about the press, how manipulative it is. But, you know, again, this is also the guy that was tabloid television star. So he is very, I think, comfortable with the media and knows how to tickle it with his late night tweets and such.
As his administration moves forward, as Watergate becomes a bigger and bigger issue, John, what mistakes did Richard Nixon make? Once Watergate became public, once we knew about the break-in itself, what mistakes did he make that, had he not made them, could have prevented this thing from spinning completely out of control?
I don't want to step on another soundbite.
No, go ahead.
Are you going to use the Always Remember clip from the final goodbye?
Yes, but you go ahead. Okay. You go ahead, and we'll deal with that anyway.
I think you know, that tragic flaw, that insecurity, that paranoia came out. The practical mistakes that he made were two. One was that he couldn't get J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI to do the dirty tricks for him that they had done for previous presidents, because Hoover was getting old. He wanted to leave a sterling legacy himself, and he was afraid that they'd get caught in this new spirit of the 60s and it would tarnish the FBI. And so Nixon decides to bring the dirty tricks in-house, and he hires these guys called the Plumbers, and they're the bunch of sad sacks, and they completely bungle their first job, and in classic bureaucratic fashion, they get promoted to be somebody else's problem, and they get moved over from the White House to the Republican campaign, and 6 months later, they get caught with their surgical gloves and their business suits in the Democratic National headquarters. So that was the first mistake, was to think that he could somehow run something like that out of the White House and it wouldn't catch up with him. But the second thing was that he participated fully in the cover-up, and it was all captured on the White House tapes. And so his great problem then became, I can't let anybody listen to these tapes because they'll show that I did obstruct justice. And when finally the Supreme Court ruled against him and said that he had to give the tapes up, then it was gone.
You know, John Pruitt and John Farrell, forgive me for invoking another writer in our conversation, but Evan Osnos has a really fine piece in this week's New Yorker looking at how presidents who have been in some ways threatened with or could have been on the verge of impeachment. And he talks about mistakes that Nixon made. And he says a really important thing that I think you both were going to want to weigh in on. He says one of the big mistakes, of course, is that Nixon flouted the co-equal power of the branches of government. He did not honor or respect congressional authority, special prosecutorial authority, and that was a terrible mistake that the American people were not going to accept. Do you both find that interesting?
Go ahead, John.
I find that quite interesting, Bill, and I want to read the article. It sounds like an interesting premise.
Well, I'll say this. I talked to President Ford when I did my book about Tip O'Neill, and we got to talking about Richard Nixon then. And Gerald Ford said that Nixon's great contempt for Congress was a major reason in his downfall, not just because Nixon had watched Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower, very strong presidents, give a stiff arm to Congress and thought that he could as well, but in the 72 election, when Nixon was running up this huge landslide, and he could have elected many more a Republican congressman to office and maybe made Gerald Ford Speaker of the House, which would have solved an awful lot of his problems when it came to impeachment. Nixon instead was much more concerned about running up the score, making this a big, splashy a landslide victory for himself.
For himself. Yeah.
For himself, yeah.
What about the pardon of Nixon by Ford?
Well, could we get to something before then? Because I want to ask each of you as journalists about this. Let's play one more soundbite, and then I want to know where each of you Johns were when this happened.
To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress. In a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
So that was August 8th, 1974. And because we're a little short on time, I really wanted to hear from each of you what your recollections. John Pruitt, I know you were working here in Atlanta. John Farrell, were you working at a newspaper at the time?
I was 21, and that night was my rehearsal dinner for my ill-fated first marriage. We got married the next day.
All right. Oh, John Pruitt, what do you recall about it? Where were you?
I was in the newsroom watching this with stunned disbelief and wondering when, if ever, we would ever have a local newscast, because I knew the networks were going to carry this forever, and they did.
John Farrell. Appropriately. That was one of the most astonishing moments that I think any of us who have in American history, yes?
I think so. And I think, again, that speech that he made the next morning from the East Room. Trisha wrote this in her diary. I just love this. Daddy is speaking. People are letting tears roll down their cheek. Must not look, must not think of it now. The real Nixon is being revealed as only he can reveal himself. By speaking from the heart, people can finally know Daddy. It's not too late. Isn't that a wonderful, from a devoted daughter? And then Nixon is giving this speech about his mom and his dad, and then he ends with, "Always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them, and then you destroy yourself." And that was the hard-won, painful moment of self-recognition. I just think that's an amazing moment of American history.
Do you think Nixon gets enough credit for his ability to write and deliver speeches? Because he had some remarkable speeches throughout his career that were beautifully delivered.
I think I'm correct in saying this. I think he was the last president who spent a lot of time writing his speeches. He would go up to Camp David and just put everything on hold for a week or 10 days and write the speech himself. He'd have speechwriters to polish and to research. But Nixon was very proud. And from the very beginning, he always memorized his speeches, never spoke from note cards. Amazing public speaker.
You know, we're not going to have time to play that clip that you just talked about, John Farrell, Nixon in the East Room. But Lisa Clark, why don't we post that on our website so people can watch him say goodbye to his White House staff. John Pruitt, you dealt with Richard Nixon once in Savannah.
He came to Georgia to campaign for Hal Suit, who was a Republican candidate for governor.
And a former colleague as an anchorman.
And a former news director. Of course, Jimmy Carter defeated Hal Suit soundly. And I would venture the opinion that Watergate and Richard Nixon made the avenue possible for a Southerner who campaigned on a platform of never lying to you, of representing a government better than the American, as good as the American people are. Richard Nixon and Watergate made the Carter presidency possible, and the pardon of Nixon by Gerald Ford.
John Farrell, you were too young to have come face-to-face with Richard Nixon when he was making his way through government, right?
The only time I was a spectator at the inaugural parade in 1969 when the anti-Vietnam war demonstrators started pelting his limousine with cans and rocks and stuff. And so I could see him through the window of the limo as it went by on Pennsylvania Avenue. But that was the only time I ever saw the man face to face.
I was in eighth grade when the Republican National Convention came to Chicago to the International Amphitheater. I went down because I was already a political junkie. Somehow I got roped in. I did not have a pass, but someone came outside and asked if we kids, I was with friends, wanted to be part of a demonstration, and we ended up on the floor of the Republican National Convention on Thursday night
when
Nixon came out to give his speech. So that's my hit. John Farrell, your Richard Nixon, the life, has just been such a pleasure to read, and I think John Pruitt and I agree we've learned so much. Thank you for joining us today and for giving us this wonderful biography. It's been great having you here.
Well, thanks to all my good friends in Atlanta.
Okay, and John Pruitt, it's such a pleasure to see you again. You should come back. We should do this more often.
I'd love to.
All right, good.
Write another book, John. Write another book.
That's about it for us today. My thanks to Jenny Ahmed, to Tyler Morris, to Lisa Clark for their work on the show today. PoliticsGPB is our Twitter handle. Stay in touch with us using that handle. Follow us there. We're going to be back on Friday at 3 o'clock. We have an all-journalist panel for you. Tamar Hallerman of the Washington Bureau of the AJC, Jim Galloway will be here, and another former colleague of ours, John Pruitt, Lori Geary, will be here. We're going to talk about the 6th District Congressional race. We're going to talk about where the health care bill stands by Friday. We're hearing rumors this afternoon that Republicans in the House may have finally found a way to pass this thing. We'll see how that turns out. So come on back. Be with us again on Friday at 3. And, of course, if you can't listen to us when we're on the radio, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And we post everything on the Political Rewind website, gpb.org/TWS. Thanks again for listening. See you again Friday at 3.